Hi, Carrington.
Hi, Kevin. How are you?
I'm good. Let's do a podcast, Carrington.
That sounds like a great plan. I am on board. What do you want to make it about?
You are likely to be eaten.
You are likely to be eaten by a group. If this predicament seems particularly cruel, consider whose fault it could be. Now the torture of a match in your inventory. You are likely to be eaten by a group. If this predicament seems particularly cruel, consider whose fault it could be. Now the torture of a match in your inventory.
Okay, let's play Zork.
Excellent.
I'm done.
Yeah, me too. Man, it was hard.
Well, that was a coincidence. By a staggering coincidence, I happen to have just played Zork. So that worked out well.
So let's see, what are we doing? This podcast is we are going to play Infocom games. We're going to do it as fast as possible, which I figure is going to be like one a month. And then we're going to talk about it. And that's the conceit for this podcast, right?
I am ready to be conceited.
Excellent.
I have a quick question for you, though. I have a burning question that I've been actually thinking about the last couple of weeks. Are you a take or a get person?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm a get person.
Ah, I'm a take person. And it's longer. Really? It makes no sense. I've been aware of it this month that it turns out I'm a take sword, take lamp, take all kind of guy.
Yeah, I think I'm a get person just because you can type it all in the left hand and it's shorter.
In all ways, your answer is good. I don't know why. I started doing it that way as a kid, and it just never changed.
Right. Yeah. So my question for you is, we both played Zork, and you tweeted about it at one point. You were playing it on your Apple, and did you play the entire game through on actual classic hardware?
I did indeed. As many of these as I can, I'm going to play on old hardware. Not always Apple IIs. I've got a couple of versions for other old 8-bits. But when I can, I'm going to go retro for these. And I have a lot of the original Infocom games for the Apple II. And I have two gray boxed copies of Zork 1. So I grabbed one of them to play. And I got to compare the two. And it turns out they had slightly different contents. So that was interesting.
Interesting. Cool.
In fact, I've got the box right here in front of me right now. I'm holding it to remind me.
Ooh, neat.
What about you? How did you play it?
Well, I started playing it on my phone. I have there's an app on the iPhone called Lost Treasures of Infocom, which you throw, I think it's $12 at it, and you've got just like a ton of games and all the maps and all the original InvisiClues and everything. And I want to put it out there right now. I don't feel guilty or bad in any way about using a phone to do this, because from the beginning, these games were designed to be played on multiple platforms. They started on mainframes and then, you know, basically all sorts of different 8-bit machines, and they built this amazing virtual machine that could was designed to be played on many different platforms. So I figured my phone's just another platform. I don't care. And I needed something to do, frankly. I needed something to do on my phone for a while that kept me off the social media, because things were making me extremely frustrated and sad after the election, and I needed something new to do with my phone. So I was like, I'm going to play Infocom games.
That is an excellent distraction. Well chosen.
Thank you. Yeah. And then at one point I actually did switch. One of the times, well, I'm sure we'll talk about this later, one of the times I had to restart the game from scratch.
One of the many.
I was tired of using the small screen, so I used an Atari emulator on my Macintosh and played the Atari 8-bit version. So that was my combination. But no actual real old hardware, just my phone and then my Mac.
Right, and we should mention, I think it's probably been clear to most people so far that we are going to talk about Zork 1 in this episode. So that is the game that we both have played, which is, I guess, I've been reading about it, and this is something I didn't really realize at the time, but there was the original Zork, that was like the mainframe game, a PDP 10 or something like that. And then this Infocomized commercial version, Zork 1, was roughly half of the original Zork. So it was shrunk down to be able to fit into the home micros of the time. So that is the version we played.
Yeah, I had read that Zork, the original MIT mainframe Zork, is actually Zork 1, 2, and 3, more or less. They massaged it and changed things. But that must have been a huge-ass game.
It was like a full megabyte. Which at the
who's
time...
got that kind of...
Well, who had it? At the, well, sure. Like, it wasn't going to run on a TRS-80 or an original Apple II or something. So that is right. Why they had to shrink it down.
Right.
Yeah. And you're right about the... I knew that these were always in what I call a Z machine, what I guess the rest of the world and the developers would have called a Z machine, with this Zork implementation language business, the virtual machine, with this idea, like right from the get-go, of saying we will have basically an interpretive language that is specific to the games we want to make, and then we can just port that over to various micros, and suddenly you open up to a bunch of platforms. Really, really smart for something created so early in home gaming. So just an amazing, amazing little bit of wisdom there, forward-looking thinking from the Infocom.
Yeah, absolutely. And they did all sorts of smart things, like they managed to squish text into, I think it was 5 bits, so they could save room, because you know this floppy disk didn't hold a lot of information. So and you know, text takes up a lot of space, so they compressed it down so it would be in as little space as possible, and made it so they could release in, you know, basically 8 or 9 different platforms simultaneously. It's pretty brilliant.
Such wisdom. I learned a bunch of things by watching. There's a post-mortem, they call it, for at the Game Developer Con. Dave Liebling, I think it was, one of the guys from, you know what, I'm going to say it was him. So one of the guys from Infocom did a post-mortem of the game, like talking about the design of the game. And there's a YouTube video of that. And so we'll link to that in the show notes. Oh, there will be show notes over at monsterfeet.com. So all the things that we will learn to mention in the podcast. And if you haven't watched it, it's amazing and definitely, definitely worth watching, because he talks about the design, quote unquote, of Zork and of the original game, and then also what went into making Zork 1, 2, and 3, and how it wasn't really a designed game. It was kind of make it up as you go. And I think the game plays that way. Like a lot of it is, oh, and now we go here. And it seems kind of episodic, like different sections of the game are their own little thing. And what it all does tie together with this overall idea that you got to pick up a bunch of treasures and stick them in a trophy case. That's not a lot to hang a plot on. And so I found there's some stuff in the game, like the mazes and stuff, that I do not like at all. I didn't like them back then. I don't like them now. I think it's a terrible way to do a game. And while this is an influential and important game, and I do love everything Infocom, Zork included, there are parts of Zork that kind of scream early text adventure, and I don't dig those parts that much.
Yes. The whole thing, I think, with Infocom... And this is like basically their first product. I think it was their first product. And Infocom, their deal was that they were better text adventures. It wasn't like two words like the Scott Adams or the Roberta Williams, where it was, you know, take lamp or get lamp. And that's all you could do. I mean, literally, you could say things with the Infocom, even in I did things like take all... but timber. And it's like, sure, got it, you know, and it understands more complicated things, or, you know, Kilgrew with sword or whatever you're gonna do. And so it was definitely smarter, but this first effort isn't perfect, and I feel like I'm just gonna come out to say some blasphemous things here that say, like, this is a fun game, but it's not... It's a great starting place, but man, it's not perfect. It really does have some problems, and I don't know. I just feel like I'm going to get nasty emails about just saying that. But
well, I don't think so. Because I think people who love this game the way that I do, a lot of the love has to come from nostalgia. Like I played it back then. I never was able to finish it. back in the days before I cheated.
I want to talk to you. Did you play this back in the day?
I did. I played it as a kid. I got almost nowhere in it. Like I did in most Infocom games. I really liked them, and I was terrible at them. And so I never finished this until just a few years ago, sometime in the 90s or something. I would have come back to it. I would have used maps. I would have used cheats. I would have had help. And then only then was I able to finish this game.
I played it on my Apple IIc, a pirated version. And it's funny. I believe I finished it.
Oh, my goodness.
But I pirated the game, but I had to buy the InvisiClues, so they did make some money off of me.
See, there you go.
Damn it, InfoGum. My mom took me to some bookstore to buy the InvisiClues. So, yeah, I finished it. And, it wouldn't have been possible when I was a kid. And inasmuch as I forgot most of it, it wasn't really possible as an adult either. There's logical leaps and things in here that are make it impossible. This game is not possible to finish without hints.
I think so too. I think, and that is part of why I don't think it's a well-designed game. I think there's things in here that I don't see how the game designers ever thought anybody could finish them without hints. I don't know if maybe it was just using information that their circle of friends all kind of knew, or you get too close to the game, so you know the solution, so everybody knows it, and then you beta test and it seems fine. But I have no idea how anybody finished this when it first came out before there were things like hints, because I think it's relatively impossible game. That said, it's still something I really like, because I have a lot of nostalgia for it. I think it's a very funny game. One of the things Infocom does really well is humor, and this has tons of that, and I really dig it. I like the feelies, even though they're not really great in Zork, because it's still kind of an early game, so the feelies are okay. But I mean, overall, I really like it, but I don't think people would be upset for us not saying it's great, because I think if you don't have a nostalgia connection to it, and this was your first text adventure, it might turn you off the entire genre, because it's funny but impossible. And if you do have a nostalgia connection, then you're going to have played it, and you're going to understand that it's kind of ridiculously difficult.
Right. Yeah, I had the nostalgic connection. I don't think it's absolutely necessary to have that, but it helps for sure. It gives it I think it adds a tolerance that's necessary.
That's what this game needs. It needs tolerance.
Tolerance. Low cunning and high tolerance.
There you go. So I learned in playing the game and then reading about the game, I learned a bunch of things that I never knew before. I never knew where Gru came from.
Tell me what you learned.
Okay, so Gru, do you know where the monster Gru comes from?
No.
It's a sci-fi fantasy writer, Jack Vance, and he had this whole Dying Earth series of books. I have not read any of them, but all these early gamers seem to be big fans of his books. And in those books, there was a mythical monster, the Gru, spelled the same way, G-R-U-E, that was supposedly part ocular bat, part unusual hoon, whatever that is, and part man. And so that's they actually took the word Gru from the books as just a monster. So I learned that. I learned where the word Zork comes from. I never knew it was a thing that had kind of a meaning before. And it was just MIT slang for an unfinished program. So something was a Zork. And that's where they got the name from. And then because they hadn't picked a name yet. And then when they decided to publish, they picked Dungeon. They said, we'll change it to be called Dungeon. And then TSR, the people who had Dungeons & Dragons, said, copyright infringement.
No.
Yep. Yeah. And so they went back to Zork. And to me, it's Zork is the Zork game, like a made-up thing. But it was actually just already a word for an unfinished thing. So temporarily, they were calling it Zork.
Well, what I learned, Wikipedia, which, is never wrong.
Never.
Said that Zork was, over the lifetime of Infocom, was one-third of their game sales.
Over the whole life of Infocom?
The whole lifetime. And it said it actually increased over time.
That's crazy. But yeah, actually, that's not crazy, because I remember, because I'm super old, that there was this period in the early 80s where Zork itself was pushed as kind of like the essential program. Like there was the whole VisiCalc idea, and which is funny because Personal Software, the people who published VisiCalc, were the publishers of the original version of Zork before it came back to Infocom. Everybody knows like the killer app was VisiCalc, but I mean, I remember for a bunch of years there, 83, 84, whatever, Zork was the, no, if you're buying a computer, you'll need a game, and here's a game that is everyone should have, especially early ones when they pushed it like crazy.
And then, and personal software, I mean, they could have had VisiCalc and Zork. I mean, but for whatever reason, they decided that, oh, you know, we need to business, we're a business company now. They could have had like the number one and number two program, and they kind of stepped away from it. Yeah, but it was originally published by Infocom in 1980 and developed before that at MIT between 77 and 79. So this is pretty early. Early thing. The other thing I learned, we talked about the Feelies earlier, and the Feelies is the stuff that comes with the game in the package.
I love the Feelies. I love all Feelies in all.
So sometimes it was a map, sometimes it was magic glowing rock, sometimes it was buttons or, you know, plastic eyeglasses or whatever. So I think Zork, you can tell, I mean, you've got the package there. We should talk about that.
Right here.
It was supposed to come, according to Wikipedia, with a Zorkmid, an actual metal coin, but then didn't because of production difficulties.
Yep. It doesn't say on the box that you'll get a coin. If you look at the picture on the back of the box, which I'm holding right here, it shows the box opened up where you see the Great Underground Empire, a history book, which is kind of the big feeling that comes with it. And it shows a copy of the totally useless map that comes with it. And it shows that coin in the picture. But the text just reads, buried deep within every Zork 1 package, your Zork 1 disc, a complete history of the Great Underground Empire, and an incredible map not sold at gas stations known to mankind. So it shows
map.
The coin, but they left it off the text because you don't actually get a coin. You got the coin with the Zork trilogy package, but I don't have that package.
My Lost Treasures of Infocom app on my phone has pictures of the Feelies, and you can see the box and you can read the back, and it's kind of nice. You can rotate things and whatnot. And it actually has a picture of the coin, but, you know, and you can see both sides of it and everything. But so I can sort of enjoy it, but no actual coin. And it's got, what's his name? Dimwit the Flathead.
Right.
Yeah. It's kind of cute. Dimwit the Flathead. That's who you want on your coin.
Yep.
So tell me about what else is in the package.
I'm going to open it right now. So you get the you get that booklet, the Great Underground Empire History, which tells you about the Flatheads. And inside
which I thought was boring. I read it, and it was just like, wow, it's dull.
It is. It's got some bits of humor, but I don't think enough. And plus, most of that booklet is like instructions. So it looks like you get a big history, but you actually only get a few pages.
Right.
So
it's like really five pages of the rise and fall of this empire and the kings. And it's just like, I don't care. It's not helping me in the game. It's not.
They were still kind of hitting their stride. So, and they weren't yet using the Feelies as a copyright or as a DRM methodology, which they'll use later with things you have to look up and stuff to be able to play the game or be able to finish the game. So they weren't. So it's kind of dull. So I got the Zork 1 disc, 5 1/4 inch floppy. I got the purple Open This When You Really Need a Hint booklet about how to get the Infocom hint books and maps and stuff. You can send off for those. I got a boarding pass that lets me get the 4-in-1 sampler for free so I can sample some other Infocom games. I got their big passport. You can tell this is a later box because it's got the passport that shows tons of different things. So this would have been a game sold in like 85 or 86 or whatever when they started coming with the whole booklet to say, hey, we've got a bunch of Infocom games. I've got a big fold-out, this looks like a fold-out poster. I never even looked at this. Let's see what I got here. Oh, yeah, so it's a fold-out poster showing me also more interactive fiction games I can get that are mystery, fantasy, science fiction, or tales of adventure. This is a very large poster.
Keep that list open. Later on, we're going to pick another game.
Exciting. I've got an orange, or rather like an orangey-yellow. This is something that came in a bunch of different colors, depending on when you get it. But an orangey-yellow Apple II instruction booklet to tell you how to do it. Depending on the different boxes, you always get one of these, but the colors seem to change. I got the actual crappy map that comes with it, the yellow map that's kind of a map of the Underground Empire, but it's all in that weird text and you can't read it. And I find it doesn't really correspond to the way the game is laid out in my head, so I find the map useless. And it's not like a nice cloth map like you get with like Ultimas or something. But then the best thing, the reason I picked this box versus my other even more beat up box, is this has my favorite thing that I ever got in a Zork box of any sort. And it didn't come with it. It's a printout presumably from the person who owned this originally, because this is a box I acquired, I don't know, maybe off eBay or something. I don't know when I got it. I've had it for years. But there is a yellowed, printed 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper that clearly was tractor feed paper. You can see from the edges, like all the stuff has been peeled off, the little tractor things. You get that rough edge on the right and left. And it's been printed on a dot matrix printer. And it's the very end of the game. So it's a transcript. So here begins a transcript of interactive fiction with stories. Like, so you can, playing any Infocom game, you can just start to pipe out to your printer a transcript so you can go through things. So somebody did this, but they must have done this knowing they were right at the end of the game. Because it picks up with, at the last location. I won't say it yet because we're not spoiling yet, but it picks up at the very last location. And all it is a half page printout of the very last part of the game. So somebody.
As if to prove, I finished it. Take the printout to school or to work. Look, I finished it.
Totally, as proof that it actually got finished. So
right.
I love that. It's not even an official feely, but it's my favorite thing in the box.
Oh, that's cool. Nice. Yeah, so it has the little book and has the feelies, and the map is useless.
I have another map. I've got one of the official Department of Tourism maps or whatever that... Mm-hmm. They've come put out like a cheating map that shows all the locations.
Right.
I used that heavily in this playthrough.
Yeah, I used that. It was part of the app I used had that map. And then later I found an online version, which I'll have a link to in the show notes. Someone else made a map in 1990 or something. And it's a very very clear map that shows – makes things very, very clear and a little easier to read than the official tourism version. And it shows you things that, like, there's one room that's above another room, and there's no way to know this really in the game, that one room is directly above another room, and that's important. And yet this map, they've managed to lay it out so that it's pretty clear, so that was helpful to me.
So did you finish?
So I got so close, and I was just like, okay, so this game, there's no lose. There is lose. It doesn't tell you. It's very frustrating. This game is, some of the other Infocom games I've played, there are multiple endings. There is the best ending, and there's like, oh, wow, you really did lose, and there's deaths, of course. And then there's sort of like, you could have done better. This one, the game is going, and then you can win only with the maximum number of points. And then you've won the game. That's it. This game, it's so easy to lose the game, and there's no way to know. There's literally no way to know that you've screwed things up, and you cannot win the game. And I think I can say this without spoiling anything. I killed the thief early on, which is something that you need to do. And there's a thing that the thief needs to do you a favor
first. Were you careful about the timing of that?
So one of the first things I did was kill the thief. Like, wow, that's out of the way. And I didn't get the favor done from him. And so I play the game, blah, blah, blah. And now here I am in the very end of the game. And wait, there's like a lot of stuff that hinges on that favor that the thief didn't do for me. And I was just like, God, and I didn't want to restart the game again, because I made a list here. Let me find my list here. I had to restart the game, or, you know, either restore and go way back or restart several times, because I screwed things up in a way that made the game impossible. And of course, you don't know that. It doesn't tell you, oh, wow, you know, you can't win the game now. But, you know, I ruined the candles in a couple of different ways, and had to start over. And the thing with the thief, and there was something else stupid that I did.
I did a thing with the garlic I shouldn't have done, and I didn't even realize until later. I'm like, oh no, and I had to restart because of that.
Yeah. So at the end of this particular game, when I realized, I was just like, you know what, I'll just try to finish the game with less than the maximum points. I'm close enough. And then I realized that's not a possibility. You can't get to the end game unless you have the maximum points. So I ended up with 338 points out of 350. It said my level was wizard, And I just gave up. I'm just like, you know what? I'm not going to start this over again and do everything all over again because to get the last couple of prizes. And I was just frustrated with it.
And I think that's an example of bad game design, because it is very easy to completely make the game unwinnable and have no idea. And you can do that relatively early as well. And then you, like in your case, have to start basically completely over. And that's just disheartening as a player.
Right. And I did that a couple of times. And it's like, but the third time, you're just like, rah, no, you know, no, not going to do it. So I feel like I really played the game. I got to within inches of the end and, you know, just decided I've had enough. Did you finish it?
I did. But again, I cheated good. Like crazy. I used the map. I consulted a couple of cheat things because I couldn't. Because I having played it before, I knew all the various elements. But I'd be like, oh wait, where is that again? Where did I find this item? And so I would browse through a walkthrough looking for particular words. I got the 350 points, and I think that gave me a master adventurer. Really, it should have said big fat cheater. I totally cheated all the way through.
I started off like trying to be relatively pure. You know, I was like, I'm going to try to be good and not cheat too much. And the one pass I absolutely gave myself was the maze. I knew there was a maze, I just like, that's not fun to me. That's never been fun to me. I'm going to use, you know, I'm not even going to try to map the maze. And the fact is, it's not really a maze. There's sort of 2.5 mazes.
Yes, exactly. There's I would say two, definitely.
Yeah.
There's two distinct different mazes. And also, the thing that bothered me, as I hated it as a kid, and I've never stopped hating it, is when you go north and then go south and you don't end up back where you started.
I hate that. It
bothers me because that's something that is made artificially different because we're playing a text game versus doing it in real life. Because if I walk north and it curves around to my right, I'll know, even if I got, like, I can't remember what's north or what's south, I know what hole I just entered from. I should be able to go back to get back where I wanted. And you can't do that here. I find that that's an artificial way to make a maze harder, and it's just annoying. It messes up your mapping, and I do not like it at all. So, yeah,
not even just the maze. I feel like I found that I'm pretty good at mentally mapping things. Mm-hmm. But even just, like, in the main part of the game, sometimes to exit a room exit room A to go to room B, you go north. But to get back, you have to go southeast, or you have to go east or something. It doesn't make sense. And, you know, it's like you go north, fine, and you go south again, it's like, no, you can't go that way. And you've got to go east to go back to where you started. It just makes mental mapping very difficult. It doesn't... it's frustrating to me.
I agree completely. I mean, if you think about it, the very beginning of the game, like, it's sort of an iconic beginning because it's the west of a house. You know, you're standing in an open field west of a White House. I didn't even have to look that up. It's so iconic. I know the wording. Yeah. But if you go south from there, you end up on the south side of the house. So by going south, you really go south and east. And then you go north, and you go north and east again. So, but if you just say go south, in my mind, I think I'm going directly south. I should now be southwest of a White House, not south of a White House. So from the very first square, Zork is doing that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And boo, I say.
You know, and from the first square, I'm not probably being pedantic here, but I really wanted to know, even after reading all the feelies and everything, like, I realize this is an adventure game and we're collecting treasure, but I wanted to know, what's the story? Who is this person? Why is he here? And why is he collecting the treasure and putting it into a case, which is not made at all clear, actually, that you're supposed to put it into the trophy case? I mean, just like, is he a looter? Is he a treasure hunter for a museum? I mean, what's my motivation? I mean, is this his house?
It's funny that you say that, because I was thinking, well, no, it's obvious what you have to do in the game. You're picking up the treasure, but I guess I only know that because I already knew that. But there's nothing given to you in game saying, okay, here's your goal. You've just showed up and you're trying to recover the lost treasures of whatever or something.
Right. And fully half of the points is putting the treasure in the trophy case, mm-hmm. which is, it's sort of implied. I don't know how you're supposed to know that unless you just know that.
I think I just knew that from before. I don't remember when I was probably told to do that. Yeah. But yeah, it only seemed obvious now because I already knew what to do.
Yeah. So it's things like that that make me think this game is not fair. I made a list of things that happened to me. I have a column that's called fair with a couple of question marks, like borderline fair. And then I have a list of things that are unfair.
That's excellent. I made a list called annoying and favorites.
Excellent.
So tell me your list.
Okay. I will try to read my own writing. The case was one of the questionable fair things. I was like, yeah, okay, you put trophies in a trophy case. I get it. I think it's time to venture into spoiler territory. What do you say?
Spoil. If you haven't played this game, hang up.
That's right.
So yep. let's fire off the spoiler horn, though we don't actually have one. And yes, so here be monsters. So from now on, it's spoilers. I like it. Good. I've been holding my tongue on a couple things.
Good, yeah. The thing where you have to give the egg to the thief. That's in my questionable thing. You try to open the egg, it says someone with more dexterous fingers and the right tools could open this. That's a tiny little hint. And I should have tried, you know, it's like, so that was in the questionably fair category. And then the thing where with the machine that makes diamonds,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and you need to put the coal in the machine and turn on the machine, which is a whole nother very interesting puzzle, and then it makes a diamond. And there's like kind of a clue when you run the machine without a coal in it, it says it turns something into slag or something. And I guess if you know, I don't know. So I thought that was just, those were all like borderline fair. But then the things that were not fair to me were, there's a terrible puzzle in the loud room. There's a loud room with a platinum bar
in it. I know it well. In fact, the loud room is in my favorites list. So I want to
really?
Hear what, yeah.
Oh, okay. Like, So the thing is, you're in this room and you type take bar, and the response it gives you is bar, bar, like it's an echo. And if you type inventory, it goes inventory, inventory. And you can't do anything in that room except leave the room, you know, through one of the cardinal directions. And the solution to the puzzle is to type the word echo. This doesn't...
That's not how I do it.
That is the solution that I found online, because I had to cheat on this. Yeah, well, I'm interested in what you did. But so, I mean, I was like, okay, here's what we're going to do. It's a sound issue, so I'm going to stuff the old leaves in my ears. That didn't work. I'm going to find the tube of viscous goop, and I'm going to try to plug up my hearing with that. That didn't work. The official solution that I found was to type the word echo. And that's it. It says the acoustics of the room subtly change, and then subtly change, and then you could type take bar and get your prize. It's just like such a stupid Scott Adams adventure way of solving a puzzle. There's no verb there. It was terrible. How did you solve it?
That's so weird. There's a bolt that you find in another room that you have to turn with the wrench.
Right.
So you type turn bolt with wrench, that closes the dam, and when you close the dam, since the loud room, which I never realized as a kid, the reason it's loud is all the water rushing over top of the room. Mm-hmm. So when you turn the bolt, you close the dam, that silences the room. Because the water has been shut off, so you can now enter through the room. And as a kid, that's why it's in my favorites, it was only through this playthrough I finally realized that it was, closing the dam. Oh, that's why the room goes silent. That noise is the rushing water over top of the room. I never really put those things together before. I didn't know about the echo thing. I always knew it was turn bolt with wrench.
Huh. All right. Well, I like that solution a lot. The solution I found was not fair because it just not fair. Also, the other thing in my unfair list was waving the scepter at the end of the rainbow. So in order to get to a certain place
in the game, that's one of your favorite things?
No, it's
one of that was on my annoying list.
We're talking fair and unfair. This is on my unfair list. You have this scepter, which examine scepter. There's nothing special about the scepter. Mm-hmm. Fine. You have to go to the end of the rainbow and wave it. There is absolutely
nothing tells you
no indication that there's no rainbow painted on the scepter. There's no. It's just that's how you get to a place in the game you've got to get, and it's terrible. And I read one of the articles in the Digital Antiquarian blog explains like some history, like there was some other game that had a magic wand that, and it's like if you knew this previous game, then this might have made sense, but there was just too much. Anyway, that was terrible.
There's no reason why, in examining the scepter, it couldn't say it has a rainbow-colored handle or something. You easily could have been something there to tell you it's got something to do with the rainbow, because there's nothing to tell you that. The only reason I know to do it is I learned it from some walkthrough or whatever years ago, and so now I know to do it. But there's nothing in-game that tells you to do that. I think it's completely unfair, and it's on my annoying puzzles. I don't like it at all.
And the third and final thing in my unfair list, well, it's not a complete list, but this is what I wrote down. There is a emerald hidden in a buoy. You're floating down the raft, and there's a buoy there. And you can take the buoy and open the buoy, and there's an emerald inside? What? Why? It just made no sense.
It's an even number of treasures.
There was 19 treasures. There's not an even number of treasures.
Oh, that's right.
It's just absolutely random. It's like the waving a scepter at the end of a rainbow. It's just too random and doesn't make sense in the context of the story. Unfair. Unfair, I say.
I agree. I agree completely.
Right. So I want to hear your lists of what were they.
My annoyings and my favorites. Annoying, okay. I listed the maze. I hate mazes. I hate the go north and south, you're not back where you were. I put that in. I put the thief on both my annoying and favorite parts. Because the favorite part in that, I think the thief is a really good and unique early solution to solve what was everybody's adventurer trick of gathering up a bunch of things and leaving them, and that's how you'd find your way through a maze. You would drop the stuff down and mark each room. And by having a thief just pick stuff up, it stops you from being able to do that. And I thought that was a neat and elegant use. So that's cool. And everybody remembers the thief, so it's like an important part of the game, so that's kind of cool. But this time, early on, I enter the troll cave, knowing I'm going to have to hit the troll a couple times. And that's another thing I don't like. Actually, it was on my annoying, is the whole like killing the thief and killing the troll almost always requires like saving and then going in and trying it. And if it doesn't work right away, you might as well just reload. And I think that is just a bad game design. But anyway, this time I enter the troll cave. I hit the troll once and daze it, and that's great. And in fact, I tweeted a screenshot of this. I was so upset about it because the thief appears. I try to swing at the troll a second time, and I'm told I don't have a sword. I'm like, really? So the thief stole my sword right out of my hand in the middle of a battle. And of course I die. And I was like, that is completely terrible writing. So that went on my all caps annoying. Speaking of all caps, the fact that the version I was playing, the Apple II version, is all caps and has no spacing between the paragraphs makes it really hard to read because it's 40 column text and it's just a massive undelineated lines.
And you should get one of those fancy lowercase cards for your Apple.
I do have one, but by default, on the version I was playing, it didn't have it. And it's funny because the Z machine, or Z machine for the Americans, it actually supports, like the spec supports lowercase right from the very beginning, but the early Apple II displays mostly didn't have it. So the early Apple II versions of Infocom games, the early versions of Zork and stuff, don't support 80 columns. You just get big text. And if there had been spaces between the paragraphs, it would make it much easier to read. But instead, it's just like a mass of rolling text. And I find it tough on the eyes. So I didn't like that. So those were my most annoying things. And then just I put puzzles and a big frowny face beside it because some of the puzzles are just totally unfair. But my favorite parts, I listed the loud room because I finally realized why it was loud. It's because the water. And that was just like a moment of like, oh my goodness, that's what's going on after all these years. So that was excellent. And the inflating the plastic to make a boat. I had forgotten about that until I saw the plastic and I was like, oh, right, because it's a boat and the boat is super useful to carry things in and stuff later. And I like the boat. So hooray for the boat. Those are my two favorite things.
Carrington likes
it. Weirdly.
Yes. Do you know that if you touch the mirror at the mirror in the mirror room, it teleports you to the other mirror room?
Oh, I did not know that.
Did you know that if you're in a room with a granite wall and you say the name of another room with a granite wall, it teleports you?
What? Really?
Exactly. No. Why would any of this happen? Who would touch a mirror? It's again, there's just no context.
Well, did you count the leaves?
No, what happens when you count the leaves?
Okay, so there's a number, 69105, that appears in a lot of Infocom games. 69,105. It's like a little in-joke for Infocom games, and a bunch of them will have that number in there. And here, on one of the outdoor things, it says on the ground is a pile of leaves. And if you type count leaves, it says there are 69,105 leaves here.
Nice.
So one of the fun things of Infocom games is figuring out which ones have that number and how to make that number appear. So here you count the leaves.
So you mentioned the puzzles. Is there any comments or thoughts on
different puzzles? They're too hard. I think some of them are too. They're made difficult by the fact that you're not doing it like in real life. Like if you could see things and stuff, things would be easier. And some are just silly. Like they clearly were just. I feel like it's very episodic. It's like somebody decided, hey, let's put an emerald in the boy, and so that just gets plopped in there. But it doesn't feel like an overall designed, harmonious game. The puzzles are more episodic. And I think some of the puzzles, it's hard to know now. Like, I know how to do them simply because I know the game relatively well. Right. And even so, I was cheating all my way through it. Because I'm fairly bad at these games. So I'm hoping as we go through episodes, maybe 5 or 6 games from now, I'll dive in and try to do one without cheating. But we'll see how long it takes for me to do that.
Yeah, what you said about, you said something like there's a lack of, forget your exact wording, a lack of cohesiveness in the game.
I could have put it that way.
You said something like that, right?
I did. I mean, I put it better there.
But I mean, I feel like they were working on, this game for Infocom was about getting the technology right. And they mostly did. The tech of the parser and cramming all the words in there and that's, but they've got that, but they're still fine-tuning the storytelling. And there's really not a sense of the character or even the character, and the place is very all over the place. I mean, there's some places, there's an Egyptian room, and then there's sort of like the cave stuff, and then there's other things that what's the hell area?
Oh yeah, Hades or whatever.
There's the Hades, but it's more like a Christian hell. I don't know, with the bell and the book, and it seems like a kind of a mish. Yeah, the candles. It seems like a mishmash, and you know, so I feel like there's throwing. It's like that game. Have you played NetHack?
Of course, yeah.
Okay, so NetHack. I mean, they say contains everything, including the kitchen sink. And I feel like this is sort of in a NetHacky way, sort of contains anything that they thought of, and they sort of threw it in there.
Mm-hmm.
And so the story, like, I don't know, it kind of gets back to my thing where they're working on the technology, but I think later they also honed story and place.
So it's almost like the story is kind of a draft version, which one might call incomplete. I believe in MIT slang, that's called a zork.
A zork. Ooh. I see
now we know
there.
Why it's called this.
Yeah.
I dig it, though. I mean, anybody listening to this part of the episode should ideally have already played the game so we didn't spoil too much for you. If you haven't played the game, then remember, don't kill the thief before you give him the egg.
Right.
Little tip. Yeah. And in my case, don't eat the garlic before the coal mines. Because that's what I did. I ate the garlic and then later got with the bat. And I'm like, oh, I can't get the figurine now.
Do you ever need to eat the garlic? I've never eaten the garlic. Okay.
No, yeah. I got the garlic and I couldn't remember what to do with it. And I was thinking you eat it and then your breath keeps something away. I don't remember. I just ate it and I don't know what I was thinking. I was tired or something. And so anyway, don't do that. Another thing I screwed up on is I got in the boat carrying the sword. So you puncture the boat. But then you kind of know that right away, right? So.
Right. Yeah, that's kind of an instant thing.
It's the subtle stuff, like, you know, killing the thief. And it doesn't tell you, oh, just so you know, you're going to be very disappointed 100 hours from now.
Right. Yeah. So, Does it hold up, Carrington?
Yes, if you played it before. Don't play this as your first Infocom game, or definitely not as your first text adventure. But I think if you've already played it, then absolutely. I still have fun playing it. If I wasn't cheating, I couldn't have finished, and I would not have invested all the hours. And then, like, if I was in your case, I also would not have restarted to go from the beginning. It's fun, but it's not that fun.
Right, yeah. I can't imagine it being, whatever, 1981, and you bought this game. And I cannot imagine the endless frustration of getting through this game without the InvisiClues, without the internet. It would just be tear your hair out. Impossible.
Mm-hmm. And this is why I did not finish it as a kid.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think I feel like it holds up in a context of, like, everything else came from this. And if you want to play it, don't feel bad about enjoying it as a place and as a story, and don't, you know, just don't feel bad about using all the cheats that you can find online.
Completely agree.
Yeah.
Cool. So shall we play another one?
I would like to play another one.
Excellent. What do you want to play?
Yeah. I would like you to pick it, but I get veto power if I don't want to play it.
Is that how we're... Okay. Then I'm going to pick one again that I've already played because I intend to probably cheat. Yeah. So
that's the thing. I've played Zork. I've only played 5 Infocom games all the way through. So I don't want to play one next that I played before. So as long as you pick one that I haven't played.
Right. Okay. Before. So then how about, have you played Ballyhoo?
I have not.
Okay. Then we should do Ballyhoo because it's one I have played. And all right. Because I can cheat again.
Excellent. So we'll play Ballyhoo, and I think we should invite listeners to play Ballyhoo. And then they can let us know. I mean, if they played it before, they should let us know any memories or thoughts about it. And if they played Zork before. But yeah, I think we should invite the world to play Ballyhoo with us.
Yes, play Ballyhoo with us and tell us how it goes. And also, if you have Zork memories, feel free to give us some feedback on that as well. I think we have a feedback email address, don't we, Kevin?
Do we? Oh, that's fancy. Oh, tell me about that.
So we are, you can email us, grew@monsterfeet.com, and you can also hit us both up on Twitter. I am at Carrington, and I think you are at Savitz, correct?
At Kevin Savitz.
Oh, at Kevin Savitz.
Yeah, I know.
Full name fancy. Yeah.
Did you think, when you, monsterfeet.com is you, right? That's your domain?
It is.
Is that right? Did you realize how prescient it was, you know, when you got that domain name that one day you would have a podcast about a monster?
My whole life has led up to this moment.
Nice. All right. So grew@monsterfeet.com or find us on Twitter. And cool. Nice.
And then we will play another game and we will record another one of these in a month or so.
Sounds good. And cool. Thank you for listening. Thank you for podcasting with me, Carrington.
You are very welcome. And I also want to give a quick shout out to MC Frontalot for giving us the permission to use the perfect theme song. Mm-hmm.
Into the slavering fangs of the lurking Gru.